Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement by Hillary Clinton that she is running for president and will champion income equality for women in particular and fight for higher minimum wages, affordable education, and childcare. Heidi Hartman, the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, joins us to discuss the ultimate shattering of the glass ceiling with the election of the first woman to be president of the United States. Then we'll speak with one of the country's premier military experts, William Arkin, about his new book, Unmanned: Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare, and how our security is being undermined by an impulse to gather as much data as possible, as well as the increasing use of America's nuclear submarines as spying platforms. Then finally, we'll examine the historic meeting between Cuba's President Raul Castro and President Obama at the Summit of the Americas in Panama and speak with a former political analyst for the Cuban government, Arturo López Levy, a professor at the Center for Global Affairs at New York University. We will discuss the removal of Cuba from the list of state sponsors of terrorism and how and when the embargo will be lifted. And joining me now is Heidi Hartman, who's the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, a scientific research organization that she founded in 1987 to meet the need of women-centered, policy-oriented research. Dr. Hartman is also a research professor at the George Washington University and co-author of Still a Man's Labor Market, The Long-Term Earnings Gap, Unnecessary Losses, Costs of Americans of the Lack of Family and Medical Leave, and Equal Pay for Working Families and Survival at the Bottom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Heidi Hartman.
Pleased to be with you.
And Heidi Hartman, the issues that you've dealt with and deal with over the years seem to be very much on Hillary Clinton's agenda. How do you think, though, this will resonate beyond the women of this country?
Great question. Well, I think many men are sharing the responsibility of raising families and paying the mortgage and the rent with the women in their lives. The women are working too, and I've certainly heard a lot of support from men for equal pay, for example. It polls just as well with men as it does with women, equal pay for women. You know, I've in focus groups, you'll hear men say things like, my wife works just as hard as I do. She comes home just as tired as I am. Why is she getting less? So these, I think there's growing support for issues like equal pay and also paid family leave. We have a lot of evidence that young men are very interested in spending more time with their families, wanting to take time off when children are born or when they're sick.
So how much do you think the Republicans are out of touch in that regard, that the reality in America is that both parents work in, I think, something like 80% of households, and the hero of all Republicans, particularly those running for president, is Ronald Reagan. And in many ways, he harked back to an atavistic kind of vision of Ozzie and Harriet's perfect nuclear family, where the wife was the housewife and the husband went off to work. Those days are over. Do you think there's a way to make that point and deal with the reality as opposed to the fantasy?
Well, I certainly think Hillary Clinton is going to be able to do that. Whether the Republican candidates can do it, I don't know. Some of them may. They do frequently talk about things like workplace flexibility. They want people not to get paid overtime, but instead to be able to take time off at other times. Now, a lot of workers are against that because they need the overtime money, and they'd rather have something like paid family leave that would give them the overtime money when they're working hard and give them pay when they have to take time off to care for their families. But the Republicans, I think, will come up with some solutions that they think are popular that will grab voters. Interestingly, there was a budget resolution vote and in the Senate, and something like 10 Republican senators voted for paid sick days as part of that budget resolution. That's a kind of costless vote because it's not actual legislation. They didn't actually vote for paid sick days legislation, but I think they voted that way to show sympathy with the American worker. These paid sick days campaigns are taking off. I mean, passed in New York City, passed in Connecticut State, Massachusetts State, California. So it's and many cities around the country. So it's really a movement that's happening, and I think they know that.
But most of them, if not all of the Republican candidates, are on bended knees before the Koch brothers. We just learned that Ted Cruz, the first to announce on the Republican side, who suddenly got a huge influx of over $30 million. It all came from a hedge fund fellow. So there's no question that since Citizens United, money drives our politics. And how do you think Hillary Clinton can fare? Her husband's clearly a huge fundraiser and not averse to raising money from wealthy people. But on the other hand, her announcements and her priorities are with the middle class and working Americans. So how can you run a campaign in this country without getting money from the 1% as opposed to the 99%? It just, as far as I know, it hasn't been done. Maybe it can be done.
Well, I think President Obama and his campaign, he certainly emphasized the number of small donors he had. But of course, the Democrats have been looking to Wall Street, high tech, other sectors of the economy, you know, that they essentially think are more modern than the old sectors of the economy. And that the modern sectors of the economy understand we need women workers as much as male workers. We are going to be a majority-minority country. Therefore, we have to create equal opportunity for minority children. So we need, you know, comprehensive health care. We need better public education. So, you know, there's always, in my view, a kind of group of, you know, what you could call far-thinking capitalist people who are a little bit ahead of the game, who realize that to preserve the economic system they have and to make it stronger and more efficient, they need to take care of these social problems. You can't just ignore them and let them fester. It affects, you know, the way in which your economy grows. It won't grow. It won't be strong if you don't deal with these issues. So I think, you know, I think the Democratic Party and Hillary especially and her husband will be able to get support from these kind of rich thinkers.
So, again, I'm speaking with Heidi Hartmann, who's the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, a scientific research organization that she founded in 1987 to meet the need of women-centered, policy-oriented research. Dr. Hartmann is also a research professor at the George Washington University and co-author of Still a Man's Labor Market, The Long-Term Earnings Gap and Unnecessary Losses, Costs to Americans of the Lack of Family and Medical Leave and Equal Pay for Working Families and Survival at the Bottom. It's not well known, Heidi Hartmann, that Hillary Clinton comes from a pretty humble background. Her first job ever when she was still a student was up in Alaska at a canning factory, cutting up fish on a production line.
I'm amazed by that story, but I do know she came from a not very well-off middle-class family, and I don't think she's ever forgotten that. I think she views the opportunity she's had, you know, the wealth she and her husband have been able to accumulate as living the American dream, as coming from humble origins. Certainly, Bill Clinton certainly came from humble origins as well, and, you know, with their success, they've been able to do well. So, but I think that background helps you realize that everyone wants that chance, and it's your responsibility as a public servant to try to give everyone that chance. You know, I think there's an area where Hillary can really add to the debate on income inequality and that class difference that you've introduced here in this topic. And a lot of people don't realize that the pay gap between men and women is a large part of that income inequality. If women could be paid equally to men who are similar to them, same age, same education, same hours of work, et cetera, we would eliminate half the poverty in families where there's a working woman. So where there's a married couple that's poor, half of those families would not be poor if women got equal pay. For single mothers, half of working single mothers would not be poor if women got equal pay. So I think she can add a gender element to the, you know, somewhat abstract discussion about class inequality and inequality between the top and the bottom. When you bring the women's element in, I think then people start thinking more about, oh yeah, This is what we, you know, call in the field kitchen table politics. This is kitchen table economics. People, I think, will understand it better. Yeah, if I made as much as my husband, I could, you know, we could buy healthier food, and we could have more after-school activities for the kids that we could pay for.
But we know, though, from a recent study that 40%, I think more than 40% of American households are headed by a woman who is the primary breadwinner. So
that's right.
This doesn't make any sense. I mean, again, goes back to my earlier question about the idea that there's this sort of atavistic vision the Harriet, the Aussie and Harriet nuclear family that simply is not the case anymore. So in the new and real America, what you just said ought to be a national priority. If over 40% of households in this country are headed by a woman as the main breadwinner, then she damn well should be earning the same wages as a man.
That's right, and yet it's a difficult problem to solve. It's not like people haven't wanted to solve this. As one of my friends, a wonderful economist, recently deceased, Barbara Bergman, used to say all the time, if politicians knew how to create good jobs with good pay, they would do it all the time. You know, people know that this, well, at least the ones that are not looking backward, the ones that are looking forward, know that this is what we need to do. But it's not always clear that we know what policy will make it happen. What, you know, how can we achieve equal pay? Some of it is better enforcement. We haven't had very strong enforcement of our equal pay laws. Some of it is counseling and telling young people what different jobs pay. And some of it is, you know, organizing the power of workers to bring up the pay of jobs that we know are very important, like, let's say, nursing or secretarial work. You know, for those of us fortunate enough to have an assistant, we need for them to know grammar extremely well, know computers extremely well, have top-notch skills. And these jobs are underpaid relative to jobs that require similar skills, but that have tended to be done by men. So to some extent, it's a question of market power, strengthening the power of workers through collective bargaining or through laws requiring, for example, wage transparency. We still have a lot of employers, according to a survey we did, that punish workers for sharing pay information. And if you can't share pay information, then you're not going to know that you're being underpaid. So we could, you know, we could have better laws that would improve the situation, keep employers from retaliating against workers that share pay and even information, and even requiring employers to share to publish basic pay information. So we could do a lot with the law, and that would require political will. And I think that is the kind of political will that Mrs. Clinton could build in her campaign. She could talk about these issues. She could talk about how important they are and talk about the policy changes that are needed, you know, to make it possible for women to have equal pay. There's other things, too, like paid family leave. I think one way we could ease into paid family leave, many countries have a social insurance system, much like our Social Security, paid for by workers and employers. And whenever you need anything, when you're sick, when you're have a family leave, it all comes from that same social insurance system. Ours is more limited. It refers primarily to retirement and disability. But we could have a big thing like that, or we could start with something smaller, like tax credits to families who have had a new child in the past year. Everybody knows it's very expensive. You know, all of a sudden you have new expenses. And so there could be ways that we could try to move toward paid family leave through something that's, you know, a little bit more common in America using our tax system. So these are some of the issues I think that she can highlight and that voters will resonate with, because they face these issues every day and they want solutions. And if she can point to, you know, some practical solutions, I think she can gain a lot of support.
So we know that, you know, President Obama spends a lot of time trying to point out that the economy's come back and that he's been largely responsible to take, you know, often people say that Obama doesn't take credit for what he does. Well, he's trying to take credit for jobs coming back, but jobs are back, but wages aren't. And the reality in America is that the middle class is treading water. working Americans are finding it harder and harder to make ends meet. One can expect on the Republican side that it'll be mourning in America and all of this patriotic stuff about how great we are and how wonderful things are. So in that environment, we recall Jimmy Carter and other Democratic presidential. Well, he actually got elected, but he didn't get reelected. And the idea is that you've got to be upbeat and positive. You can't sort of say, you know, say, look, this is not right. You know, This is where our kids are the first generation in history that are saddled with student debt before they even get a job. Child care should be a human right, just like health care is. And mm-hmm. We got a lot to do in this country. How do you navigate that? How do you basically tell the truth about how things aren't as rosy as we'd like to think they are? At the same time, give a sense that we're heading that we can head in a positive direction, but being truthful about the economic realities.
I think that's definitely the challenge that every Democratic candidate will face because they're running on Obama's record to some extent. I think emphasizing that we've had good job growth is a great thing to do. I think people do sense it's getting better. The jobs are easier to find. Not that everyone has a job, but the official unemployment rate is quite low. I think the Federal Reserve Bank is helping by not pushing immediately to raise rates. They say they will, but they're going to really be paying attention to that labor market. And if we had a truly tight labor market, wages would be rising. Now, we've seen some rising wages lately. We've seen, announcements by McDonald's and Walmart and so on that they are going to raise wages. So we will see in the data an impact of these are big employers. We will see an impact in the average wages for low-income workers going up. That is good. I think that focusing on opportunity and children and giving them everything they need, I sense a real difference in the attitude about that. I would say that 20 years ago, I would say that not every American was convinced that their child or children in general needed to go as far as they could in education, that there should be plenty of good jobs that don't require higher education. But I think now for almost every job, whether it's auto mechanic or whatever it is, there's a lot of electronics, there's a lot of computer work, certainly in healthcare. So there are just so many jobs that require these higher skills. I think most parents understand that now, and they want that for their children. They don't want to say, oh, my kid will be fine without that. And so I think, focusing on children is one way to have a clear message about the future that gives people hope. They're most concerned about the new generation. They want the new generation to do better, than the current generation. They're concerned about those college loans. I think we could do a lot to make college more affordable in this country. Yes, it would require more federal grants, but that would be the right thing to do. If everybody needs education, then the right thing to do is to make it as cheap as possible. It's what you call a merit good, just as childcare and healthcare that you were talking about. These are goods that help the whole society, and the benefit goes to the whole society. So you can't expect the individual child or the individual parent to pay the full cost of something that benefits the entire society. So that's why they're called not only public goods, but merit goods. And those kinds of goods, definitely need to be invested in by the public as a whole, which, we could do very well by increasing tax rates on some of the uber wealthy. That would be a good way to go. It's a good place to find that money that we need to support these basic programs.
Well, just in closing, do you think the American people are ready for that message that, enough already? The 1% have done so well, and they continue to do well, and it's about time that we spread a little fairness around here in this country. I mean, she's got to get out from under the image that Clintons have done well and that Bill, hangs out with billionaires.
but we've had an awful lot of wealthy presidents that have been extremely well-loved. Franklin Roosevelt came from the upper class, Teddy Roosevelt, Jack Kennedy. This is not impossible for the Americans to understand that some people who have made money really do care about them and really do want to help them. I think Americans are fed up largely with this inequality. I think they see it. I think the last, you know, recession made it all very clear. Somehow we still have lots of families that lost their houses and haven't been able to buy a new house. But it does seem like Wall Street is completely healed and is just, you know, going crazy with success. So I think people see that the economy isn't operating fairly, and they do want change. And, you know, lots of people think that Elizabeth Warren, for example, is the right candidate. But I think the value of everything Elizabeth Warren has achieved is to raise consciousness about this in the American people. And I hope that Hillary will be able to reap the benefit of that as she puts forward a program that focuses very much on economic inequality and what we can do about it.
Well, Heidi Hartmann, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Heidi Hartmann, who's the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, a scientific research organization that she founded in 1987 to meet the need for women-centered, policy-oriented research. Dr. Hartmann is also a research professor at the George Washington University and co-author of Still a Man's Labor Market, The Long-Term Earnings Gap, and Unnecessary Losses Costs to Americans of the Lack of Family and Medical Leave, and Equal Pay for Working Families and Survival at the Bottom. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with the author of a new book, Unmanned Drones, Data and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Arkin, one of America's premier military experts, having started his 40-year career in national security, serving in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War. He's written more than a dozen books and been instrumental in countless exposés. At the Washington Post, he conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America Investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name. He's been a columnist for the Los Angeles Times and national security consultant to the New York Times and NBC News. He is also the author of American Coup, and his latest book just out is Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Arkin.
Thanks for having me on.
And Bill, having a bit of problem hearing you, so tell me, why is it that we don't win wars anymore? Apparently we're not really even required to win wars anymore. And the military-industrial complex buys weapons that we don't need, that don't work, like the F-22 and the F-35, but that doesn't stop them. So there's a sort of unreal quality to the direction in which we're going.
Well, we're talking national security, so there's never really been a kind of public understanding or affirmation of it. When you speak of national security, and we speak of American national security, there's a continuity and a permanence to it that it definitely has a life of its own, and one that has certainly become more entrenched and even more permanent since 9/11, But right now, Ian, when you look, when I look at the world, when I look around, I say to myself, you know, we have this sort of era of perpetual warfare. We have this constant warfare going on in places in the world where most people couldn't even name who we're at war with right now or why. We don't have any way of kind of gauging how that the war is going or how we are doing. And basically, we're so divorced from our own military that we don't even have a lever for which to understand or intervene in the actions of our own government. So it's even worse than it was during the Eisenhower years, in a way, the man who introduced the concept of the military-industrial complex, because that was a time of industry, and you could imagine who was making money and what the interests were and why there was a certain permanency involved. And today, in the information era, it's not even clear necessarily whose interests are being served. And it's not necessarily industrial interests. Sometimes it's just the interests of a permanent class of information warriors, if you will. And they're not necessarily producing anything that is tangible. And so we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars a year on the military. And it's not necessarily even a tangible outcome that one can point to and say, well, this is a good thing or a bad thing. And so you have war that's permanent. You have spending that's enigmatic and invisible. And you have very little opportunity on the part of people who are normal American citizens to participate or even intervene in matters of national security.
Well, indeed, we have gone from military hardware to military software that dominates the spending, and as you pointed out, that most of our intelligence budget goes to intangible and amorphous things that aren't really quantifiable. But I did mention the F-35. It's an actual airplane that doesn't work and costs more than any. It's the most expensive weapon system in history. But in your new book, Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare, William Arkin, you talk about how drones are a part of the problem that you're talking about here, and that the very endeavor of putting fewer humans in potential danger, the idea that we don't have boots on the ground, we can do everything from remote control drones, places everyone in greater danger. Wars officially end, but the data machine lives on forever. So expand on that, if you will.
Well, again, I don't mean to poo-poo the notion, Ian, that there is an F-35, a jet that's built by a company, Lockheed Martin, which is also the largest defense contractor. But it would probably surprise people to know that Lockheed Martin is as much engaged in the intelligence business as it is in the production of any piece of hardware. And so I think that the point that I try to bring out in my new book and in a lot of my writings is to look at the military and the intelligence worlds, and of course those are combined very different worlds, as really slaves, if you will, to a machine, and the machine is largely an unmanned machine, and not just drones. Drones are only one piece of that unmanned machine. There's a certain automaticity involved in our national security and all of the processes of intelligence and targeting and even remote killing, that whether a man is in the loop, as they say in the military, whether there's a pilot engaged in that fight or whether there isn't a pilot engaged in that fight, the automaticity of the fight is really set by a machine that backs up that pilot and backs up that bombing, if you will. And so the important event would be the finding and the hitting of the target, and whether there is or is not an actual human being engaged in the final pulling of the trigger, if you will, is no longer even relevant. It's neither required nor is it necessarily demanded. And I would imagine, I speculate even in my book, that if drones didn't exist, this machine would continue onward anyhow, because what makes the machine powerful and what makes us sort of slaves to all of this data is that the machine sets the course of what our foreign policy and national security policy should be, rather than we're setting our course of what it should be. So when an ISIS appears, or when an Iran is in the news, or when North Korea is in the news, the process of national security, which is a process of targeting, which is a process of choosing and selecting targets and tracking targets, and then once a decision is made, if you will, once a human decision is made to go after those targets, the killing of those targets is really the final process of this machine, and that what we're able to do, whether it's with ISIS or whether it's vis-a-vis Iran or whether it's in North Korea, China, Russia, or wherever, what we're able to do is essentially collect, track, characterize, keep an eye on, and follow a set of targets, and then if America takes action, destroy those targets. And that's why that's our constant lexicon, our constant discussion point, our constant way in which we see any fight, which is, based upon a sort of set of scores, if you will, about killing the targets. And there's very little discussion about whether or not these are American interests, or whether or not we have strategic interests engaged in or involved. It really comes down to what our score is on how well we did, on how well we did vis-a-vis Al-Qaeda, how well we did vis-a-vis oppositions in Iraq, how well we did today vis-a-vis ISIS, or how well the Saudis are doing vis-a-vis Yemen Houthis. It doesn't matter. In any case, it all comes down to the same algorithm, and that algorithm is created by this data machine.
And in terms of the idea that we're just collecting all of this data, so much data that it's unlikely that we can process it all. Apparently, in a new article that you wrote, is about the homecoming of the USS Annapolis, which is a nuclear submarine, and apparently details of what its real task is. It's no longer an attack submarine, but an intelligence platform, and I believe a number of nuclear submarines have been changed into intelligence platforms, and they are, of course, scooping up all kinds of data around the world. Some of this was revealed by Edward Snowden, and I think wasn't the USS Annapolis even named by Edward Snowden, or in the stuff that he revealed, which he, in a recent interview that he did in Moscow with John Oliver of HBO, he basically said, that I'm not responsible for stuff that gets leaked out because I gave all this information to responsible journalists. But so what does this whole thing reveal about the use of nuclear submarines?
Well, I wrote an article in Gawker, which is a news and entertainment site that I'm now working for. And that article deals with the role that submarines play in this overall data machine and this spying apparatus. And, of course, the thing about submarines is that they can get very close to a nation's coastline and by doing so can often, in a stealthy way, be in places where it might not be so obvious that a satellite, a reconnaissance airplane, or a drone, or something else might be listening in. Of course, you know, one might think that everything that takes place over this cyber world, but there's still a world of cell phones and short-range radios and local area networks and things like that that are parts of how normal people communicate. And so when, as the U.S. intelligence system has changed more and more to looking for the communications of terrorists and looking for communications of guerrilla groups and insurgents, it's had to modify itself from looking at high-level communications to looking at low-level communications, and that means that those low-level communications, in order to be intercepted, you have to be quite close to them, and a submarine plays a very important role in all of that. And so we wrote an article, Adam Weinstein and myself, about the role that one particular submarine, the USS Annapolis, plays. And it was fortuitous that we found out that that submarine had been engaged in an important mission last year. We don't know exactly what the mission was, but we know where the submarine went, and it spent a couple of months in the Mediterranean Sea, in the Red Sea, and then in the Persian Gulf. And so it's pretty obvious that in that area, we're talking about Yemen, we're talking about Iran, we're talking about Israel. So we know what the targets of U.S. intelligence are, but the submarine itself, where it actually went and what types of communications it might have intercepted, what types of operations it might have even been involved in. That is, you know, that the ability to intercept the communication is just one part of how intelligence and warfare works today. A part of it is also manipulating and spoofing and interrupting those communications. And so that's what we used to call electronic warfare, but today is called cyber warfare. And so we wrote about as well the fact that this submarine is kind of the cutting edge of compute, what are called computer network operations or cyber offensive operations, and that is what really is the cutting edge of warfare today. Again, is these cyber operations, but in order to do that kind of operation, one has to collect an incredible amount of intelligence in order to begin to isolate the very communications down to the cell phone, down to the local area network, down to the home Wi-Fi system, in order to have an impact on whatever the target is.
Well, William Arkin, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate your joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with William Arkin, who is one of America's premier military experts, having started his 40-year career in national security, serving in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War. He's written more than a dozen books and been instrumental in countless exposés. At the Washington Post, he conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name. He has been a columnist for the Los Angeles Times and national security consultant to the New York Times and NBC News. He's also the author of American Coup, and his latest book just out is Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the historic meeting between Cuba's President Raul Castro and President Obama at the Summit of the Americas in Panama. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Arturo López-Levy, a former political analyst for the Cuban government, who is a professor at the Center for Global Affairs at New York University, where he teaches Latin American politics and comparative politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arturo López-Levy.
It's a great pleasure, Ian, to be back with you.
And Arturo, it's obviously this meeting at the Summit of the Americas in Panama between President Obama and President Raul Castro of Cuba. Obama has referred to it as being historic. It was pretty extraordinary, it seemed quite personal when Cuba's President Raul Castro called Barack Obama an honest man and went on to say that Obama bears no responsibility for the decades of hostilities between the two countries. Quoting Castro, "There were 10 presidents before him, all have some debt to us, but not President Obama." And he went on to say, "I have read his books and I admire him and his life. I think a lot of his behavior has to do with his humble background." So that's a pretty personal endorsement, if you will, of a fellow leader. You don't hear that too often, even amongst friends.
Well, it's very unusual for a revolutionary leader in the world. And you have to understand that Raul Castro comes from a tradition that is revolutionary at its core. He was a guerrilla fighter against a right-wing dictatorship supported by the United States at the time. And he even, when he described in his speech his political life, he mentioned the Bay of Pigs and other episodes. It's something unusual. And it clear demonstrate that the Cuban Revolution has gone to its most radical phase and it's in its way back. And you cannot disassociate this from the reality that President Obama has looked at this issue, the Obama administration has looked at the Cuba issue on its merit based on facts. And there is the hope soon Cuba will be out of the nation of sponsors of terrorism list of the State Department, because for quite a long time, many administrations, basically due to the Cold War logic first and later to the role of the Cuban-American lobby in South Florida, they basically use all kind of allegation against Cuba. And don't take me wrong, there are important differences between Cuba and the United States in terms of values, conflicts, and all these things. But during history, it never helped when real concerns were mixed with unfounded allegations.
Well, it does seem that at the last Summit of the Americas, President Obama was lectured by a lot of the Latin American leaders. The Argentinian president said, you know, this referred to the Cuba blockade as an anachronistic blockade. And he was lectured by Bolivia's president, behaving like a dictatorship, etc. He did actually chide the president of Ecuador, President Rafael Correa. But clearly, given that the Latin America and South American leaders, and there's 35 countries represented at this summit, they've been extremely unhappy about this policy. What's your sense of how this will change? One would expect it will change America's relationship with the entire hemisphere.
Ian, you are very clear and right on point when you bring to the table the issue of Latin America in this triangular relationship between Cuba, the United States, and the rest of the hemisphere. Why? Because the U.S.-Cuba relation is an asymmetrical relationship in which basically Cuba has won against the embargo because it has survived a policy of sanctions to the point that it made the sanctions irrelevant. In some sense, well, if they are not irrelevant because they cause a lot of harm to the Cuban economy and the prospects of economic development, but on the other hand, they are irrelevant to the survival of the Cuban regime. And this is because, in some sense, after the end of the Cold War, or by the end of the Cold War, when Cuba lost the support of the Soviet Union, already Cuba was inserted in the whole international scene, and particularly in the Latin American region. This process basically took momentum with the turn to the left in the 2000s, when Brazil elected President Lula da Silva, when President Chavez became the president of Venezuela, and Evo Morales, Ortega in Nicaragua, Rafael Correa in Bolivia, and the Caribbean countries also close rank with Cuba, and they said, we are not going to cooperate in any way or form with the regime change policy organized by Washington. As a result of this, basically, we have a kind of stalemate, but Cuba was winning because in the sense that the disparity of power had become irrelevant. The United States was not able to achieve their goal of removing the Castros from power, and Cuba was surviving. And in this context, it was evident that the cost-benefit analysis about American policy towards Cuba was showing that it didn't make sense. It was not justified that Washington pays such a heavy price in distraction, animosity, condemnation in the whole region. By the way, even in Canada, for a policy toward a country that it doesn't make any sense. And then by the end of the 2000s, when Raul Castro became the president, he launched a process of economic reform and political liberalization, and the whole hemisphere had a diagnosis that said Cuba is a country in transition. And the Obama administration, that was not committed to the previous policies of other administrations, basically come out and began to explore a different approach that was already announced by the president when he was a presidential candidate in 2008. And what we are seeing now is the result of the alignment of all these trends.
And at this summit, the president of Venezuela did attack Obama. He said, I respect you, but I don't trust you, President Obama, in a speech that was fairly full of expletives. We couldn't play it on the air. Even that seems to have been taken. I think Maduro's fire was somewhat dampened by the relationship with Cuba. And that's one of the things that I find puzzling, Arturo, trying to follow U.S. foreign policy. This appears to be somewhat schizophrenic. On the one hand, we're opening up to Cuba. On the other hand, we're calling Venezuela a threat to U.S. national security. What do you make of that, of this new shift where, Venezuela is in the doghouse and Cuba is our new best friend?
Well, I think, Ian, that you are playing with words there. Cuba is not the best ally of the United States.
No, of course not.
is Cuba and the United States has a difficult relationship, but what President Obama and President Castro has shown in Panama City is that this relationship doesn't need to be antagonistic. That there are ways where there are issues that can be solved by improving understanding. There are misunderstandings between the two countries, and obviously the improvement of communication can play a positive role there. There are other issues that goes to values and political systems and things of this kind in which basically, they can manage the differences, but they are not going to solve it, at least in the short term. But there is a space there for some tactic trust between Cuba and the United States that in the long term can create new dynamics of what we can call a strategic trust. On the other hand, you have a very difficult situation in Venezuela, and President Maduro is trying to rally the nation around the nationalistic flag. And President Obama gave him a good gift when he declared Venezuela a threat to U.S. national security. There is a big difference between what was the U.S. embargo and the specific sanctions targeted to seven officials of the Venezuelan government that there are reports that located them in important positions, taking decisions that lead to violations of human rights in Venezuela. Those are targeted sanctions. But when you put together these targeted sanctions and at the same time call Venezuela a national security threat to the United States, this is not well seen in the continent. And even the Venezuelan opposition opposed to this type of classification. And then the outcome that we have is in Panama City is the outcome of two different policies. In one case, the President Obama has moved very carefully in a well thought way to deal with Cuba, and he makes some mistakes dealing with Venezuela, and that's the outcome. That said, obviously, President Maduro is has used a lot of hyperboles. The United States is not taking the kids, the immigrant kids, from the hands, from the arms of their parents and deporting them, as he has said about the order of deportation and the crisis with children in the border. This is a cheap attack on a cheap personal attack on the president. But you know, those things are part of politics, and Obama has shown with his no drama approach that the United States can achieve their goals without creating a kerfuffle about those issues.
So when do you think then, Arturas López-Levy, that the first thing to do, of course, is to take Cuba off the sponsor of terrorism list that the State Department has? Raul Castro called for it, and apparently it's in the works. That's my assumption. But then the next stage, of course, it would be, and you made the comparison between sanctioning seven individuals in the Venezuelan government and continuing the blockade against Cuba. Do you expect that to be lifted in stages? What's your prediction on getting down to the real agenda, since the terrorism list is obviously anachronistic, but it's a precursor to getting moving on to more important relations and more important steps, which are undoing the decades-long fruitless embargo.
Ian, you know, I would say that you always need to tango, or to dance salsa in the case of U.S.-Cuba relationship. I have not been working for the Cuban government since 1994, so I have my guessing about how Cuba is looking at this issue, and believe me, there are different fractions within the Cuban elite, and some of them will look with a lot of suspicion and cautiousness any approach, any rapprochement with the United States. And you know, former President Fidel Castro has said many of the things that recently, many of the things that President Maduro said, particularly this idea of not trusting the United States under any circumstances. So it might take longer. I think that both President Obama and President Raul Castro, they were right when they called for some patience. But it was very important in terms of Cuban domestic politics that President Castro said, President Obama wants to end the embargo. It is our duty. When he mean our duty, mean the duty of Cubans and also Latin Americans and Caribbean leaders to support him on this target, on this task. And it's quite interesting that he said that, because it shows, it gives a lot of political space for those people within the Cuban society that would like to see a more positive attitude and constructive attitude to the approaches of the non-confrontational approaches of President Obama. A big thing here is what the United States is able to do. And a big, I would say that the major problem will be a loss of the attention on the Cuban issue in the next month, because Cuba became very important after December 17 because of the dramatic events there and the coming of the Summit of the Americas. And there are a lot of stuff here that the United States, as with the dignity of a democratic superpower, can do to improve the relationship. And some of them needs to be done unilaterally, like taking Cuba off the list of nations sponsors of terrorism. That it's an insult and a lie to that the Cuban people and the Cuban government takes very seriously. Also, by September, the president can decide whether Cuba is an enemy country or not, because there is something called the 1917 Trading with the Enemy Act, that only Cuba is still under the sanctions of the Trading with the Enemy Act. And it will be interesting to see if the president basically said Cuba should not be on this list anymore. And by the way, Cuba is the only country on the list. And by doing so, the executive branch is basically telling people we don't have any interest on punishing Cuba. And this will open the U.S. courts to claims about the right of Americans to travel wherever they want. Americans can travel to North Korea, Americans can travel to Iran, but they cannot travel to Cuba. And this restriction on our civil rights was justified always on the base of, or was justified by the executive branch, always on the base that Cuba was a threat, and this is basically where the situation is now.
Well, Arturo López-Levy, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure, Ian.
And thank you again. And I've been speaking with Arturo López-Levy, who's a former political analyst for the Cuban government, who is a professor at the Center for Global Affairs at New York University, where he teaches Latin American politics and comparative politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.